Hey, welcome to your turn, Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us today, and we're going to be following the money as per usual. Today, we're going to take a look at the federal benefits package, and this is one of those things that you probably can't know too much about it, and my guest today knows just about all there is to know about it, John Elliott. Longtime Fed, now retired. He worked for OPM, Agriculture, Customs, DEA, and Interior, I believe. And he was, the agencies were after him, and he kept moving from agency to agency because they wanted him there. So,
Step ahead of the sheriff.
Well, that too. I did see you on America's Most Wanted. But anyhow, really glad to have you with us today. And my point is, not only do you know the regular first and service, but you know the law enforcement, the LEO process too, and that can sometimes be helpful. We advertised in the column this morning for people to call in or send us email us questions, and we got a batch of questions, and I think it's probably good to go to those first because they're, some of them are of general interest, but if people took time enough to email us, least we can do is answer them, or at least John can do is answer them. First one is from Gunny, and I bet he's a former Marine. He says, if you have Medicare Part B and FEHBP, that is Blue Cross Blue Shield, I understand Part B is primary. What if a doctor does not take Part B? Will the FEHBP be primary in this case? If not, any ideas?
Well, yeah. I mean, FEHB has to pay the whole. Yeah, they do.
Okay, good answer. Okay,
but
good.
If I would caution people to check with their doctor before they take Part B, and if they say they don't take Part B, they're not a Medicare participant, in other words, then either you got some choices to make. One, don't take Part B if you want to stay with your doctor, or move to another doctor if you want to take Part B. Now, whether to take Part B or not is a longer discussion. I think we have a question on that coming up, which I'll elaborate on when we get to it.
All right, Semper Fi. This is from Dave. He says, my wife worked in the 1980s for the government. She started as CSRS, Civil Service Retirement System, had a break in service, and then came back as a FERS employee, Federal Employee Retirement System. She repaid her retirement contributions from her CSRS time in order to keep that time. She worked a total of 8 years and left in 1990. Does she get a FERS retirement at age 62 based on those 8 years of service? Boy, I'm glad you're here.
Yes, she does. But let's see. Did she say, I'm looking at this question, she worked in the 80s but under SERS, but he doesn't say how long. Oh, no, 8 years and left in 1990. Well, she has a CSRS component because she has at least 5 years of SERS, apparently. And then she came back as a FERS, as he said. So she gets one annuity check, 8 years under SERS rules, and the however many years she has under FERS, that will be her annuity. So the answer is yes.
Okay, very good. Here's one from Ted. It says, in the second to last paragraph of today's column, what are you doing the rest of your life? You ask, will you want Medicare when you turn 65? We know anyone reaching age 65 must apply for Medicare Part A. Applying for Part B is voluntary, but if someone does not apply within a certain period of time after they're eligible, the cost begins to rise on an annual basis. It appears a retiring Fed can obtain medical insurance through the FEHBP cheaper than the cost of obtaining Parts B, C, and D. I'd love to see some discussion in an insightful article about this. Can you sort of elaborate, John?
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at what your coverage with FEHBP is, and also the key question you ask is, what is your health? And if it's poor or fair to middling even, I would consider taking Part B, which covers doctor's expenses and outpatient hospitalization outpatient expenses and the like, lab costs. That's all Part B. So then I would take it. But if I'm in good health and I have no health risk factors, I'm not terribly overweight, I exercise, you all know what the health factors are, positive and negative, you might not take Part B. I didn't, because I am a low consumer of medical services. I see a doctor once a year for an annual physical, and my GIHA plan pays for all of that. And so I could be paying upwards to, you know, $1,800, $2,000 a year, depending on where the premiums are for Part B that year. And that's money I don't get back. Now, as he rightly points out, because I delayed, I'm 68 now, just had a birthday. I'm going to pay at some point this year, or if I enrolled next year, I guess, during the open enrollment, I'd pay 30% more than if I'd signed up at 65. But let's say I get a cancer diagnosis. I say, well, Part B would then be cost effective because I'm going to be seeing the doctor a lot. I can still take Part B and pay the 30% over higher the premium. Regular premium. Mm-hmm. So that might be cost effective. If it isn't, I wouldn't. But it just wasn't cost effective for me because I'm in good health, rarely get sick, knock on wood. And so it's simply do the math to decide whether Part B is right for you.
My mother was a retired civil servant, and she had, I think, Blue Cross. I talked her into getting long-term care insurance, and she had Social Security. And she was a walker. She didn't own a car, so she was in her mid-30s. But fabulous health up until the very end, and then wham, it all hit, and it was Alzheimer's. And the long-term care, the combination of Medicare, long-term care insurance, and the federal program was a lifesaver for us and the family, and it was a dignity issue for her, too. Okay, got one here from Sue. Says, tax and time-wise, does it make more sense to take the 30 days annual leave the end of retirement instead of cashing it in and letting it be taxed with little return?
Well, if you do the math, it's better to take the lump sum, and almost everyone does. It would take you a dozen years or more, typically, to make up that lump sum you didn't take. So you can do the math yourself, you know, do two annuity estimates, one extending 30 days, one not, and then find out how long it would take you to make up the lump sum. And I'll bet you it'll show you it'll take you a good long time to make up the money you didn't take.
All right, got one here from Tim. Tim says, thanks for taking my question. I started my civil service in March 1984 and have been informed by our agency specialist that I'm eligible to retire in 2018. Can you assist with understanding the impacts of retiring early? Do I require a VERA, that's a voluntary early retirement authority, or a VSEP, which is a buyout, to maintain the annuity?
Well, it's up to the agency if they're going to offer, one, early out, and two, if they're going to offer a so-called buyout, a VSIP for short, but that's typically been $25,000 before taxes are taken out. Did he say he was FERS or SERS? He didn't say.
Doesn't say, but he said he started in March 84.
Okay, let's take SERS first. Well, then he'd be FERS.
Okay,
that answers that. Thank you. Under FERS, there'd be no particular impact. You can retire early if you're age 50 with 20 years of service, or 20 if you have 25 years of service, doesn't matter how old you are. Under FERS, there's no age reduction for retiring early. There is for SERS, but he's FERS. He's got to be FERS. So there's no age reduction, so your annuity would be based on the regular FERS formula, based on how many years and months of service you have at the time you go. So there's no impact there. Plus, if you have your health insurance for 5 years immediately preceding your retirement, you take that into retirement, which is key. I wouldn't retire early unless you'd met the five-year requirement. Because that health insurance is incredibly valuable. But no, there's no particular downside. If you've done the math, you think I can afford to retire, or I'm going to another career where I'm going to get paid. So, no downside that I can see.
Very personal question, too. Okay, last one from Sharon. I'm due for my last in-grade step increase, GS 13 Step 10, in March 2015. Should I wait until after that date to file my retirement papers, and will the in-grade increase my high 3 for CSRS annuity purposes?
Well, first of all, any increase or decrease in salary in your high three period, from 99% of it is just increases. However long you're at a particular pay level is prorated. So if you only had a few weeks or a month at the step 10, she says she's a 13 mm-hmm. step 10, it would have little impact on your high three. It would raise it ever so slightly. So the longer you work at a 13 step 10, the greater your high three, you get more right. of that step increase effect. To get the full effect, you'd have to work full 3 years at a 13 step 10.
So it is prorated, and it would help a little,
prorated.
But it's probably not something to stay on for other reasons.
Again, you can do the math, but no, it's all salary increases in your high three period are prorated based on how long you were at that salary.
Okay, need to take a short break here on Your Turn. We'll be right back on federalnewsradio.com. Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. Glad to have you with us today. I'm talking with John Elliott. He is a benefits expert, longtime federal worker, now retired, and he works with the National Institute of Transition Planning, and they do seminars all around the country. You've even been out of the country, haven't you, John?
Yeah, once. Italy once.
That's amazing.
Near Florence. Italy.
It's yeah. wonderful. I mean, I think sometimes government workers don't appreciate, you might have a different view, but don't appreciate it. But yeah, I see what the government does for people in things like that versus what the private sector does. And the government, trust me, is light years ahead in most instances. John, you made me a list of things to be aware of before retirement. Let's just go down this list here. You said review OPF. What's that?
Well, it's official personnel folder, and it used to be literally a brown folder, and maybe some places still is, but a lot of them go into electronic records, but I imagine they still call it the OPF, or you want to name it a file since we've gone electronic. Whatever it is, it's a complete record of your federal history, not just your current agency. All your agency service should be contained in that file, maintained at your current agency. So when I say review it, and I do it sooner rather than later, I wouldn't, several
Don't
years.
Don't wait the last 2 weeks, huh?
Oh, no. I would say a year to 2 years in advance. Look at your OPF and make sure all your service is recorded in that file. And you can make an appointment with your HR, a.k.a. personnel office. They maintain the files. And make an appointment to review it. Now, if you're in a remote location and your file yeah. is in actually a paper folder still in around Washington and you're in Montana, your HR office can get you copies for you to review. That's essential to do.
And you're also obviously looking for errors in there.
Yeah, you're looking for missing history. That mm-hmm. would be key. You'd like to look at... if your federal health benefits form is in there, that's important to establish the fact that you had your health plan 5 years immediately preceding retirement, things like that. Just make sure everything is copacetic so there are no issues at retirement or shortly after retirement that need to be addressed. If there are problems, let's say you're missing they're missing an agency you worked for.
Yeah.
OPM, the Office of Personnel Management, that is, has established procedures in the SERS-FERS manual to reconstruct missing history. And the SERS-FERS manual is written for benefits officers, retirement counselors, what have you, and they can go through the procedures to reconstruct any missing service. That doesn't happen very often. I mean, chances are your file is complete and accurate in the vast majority of cases. So I wouldn't worry about it, but I would check verify that. Trust, but verify.
Yeah. Well, I remember, to deviate a little bit, I had a friend who was with the government, and she had worked in Chicago for Uncle Sam for some X number of years, then left government, and like many people, thought she'd never come back, so she took her retirement contributions. She came to Washington, rejoined the government, and was told by our HR office that she would not be able to retire to a certain date or she'd have to repay this money. And I remember at the time that you and I had had a conversation about this, and there was some magic window or something, and I put you in touch with her, and I brought her to tears. The news you gave her was so good.
Well, her service history presumably wasn't missing. That was, she had withdrawn her CSRS retirement funds and then returned to federal service. And she thought that,
HR told her that they gave her erroneous information.
Right. Okay.
You straightened it out.
I wasn't there.
Yeah.
I didn't hear what GSA said. Yeah. But she fell under this law where all her service for which he took a refund was before October 1st of 90, and which meant she didn't have to pay it back, and she got full credit for that service, except she did take an actuarial reduction in her annuity. But taking the actuarial reduction is far less painful than coming up with a boatload of cash. I think she owed $80,000 to $100,000,
right,
which is not untypical. So
instead of having to pay it all back, as she thought, she's paying it in, I guess, monthly increments.
Well, she shouldn't be paying it
back. Okay, it's just a smaller annuity.
Because it would take you at least 15 to 16 years, if not longer, to recoup that lump sum you handed over to OPM in higher annuity payments. So it doesn't make a lot of financial sense to pay it back.
Yeah.
Now,
well,
by the way, that 10-1-90 date was extended in that flurry of laws that was passed in 2009 to now March 1st of 1991. So
there must be a reason for that. Well, anyhow,
I'll tell you a reason for that. It was some member of Congress
exactly.
or their staff, which is whenever we get something good, you can almost bet that it's to benefit a member of Congress or their staffs.
A former head of that unit long ago once told me, long after he retired, that no significant piece of legislation, particularly dealing with retirement, ever passed Congress that didn't benefit some member or staff member.
That is true.
Yeah. I mainly wanted that example is this was an intelligent woman. She had an intelligent helper, but they were wrong. They were wrong, and were right.
You do get wrong answers, both from your HR office.
Well, as you said, trust but verify.
And also, you get wrong answers from Social Security people, too.
Here's number two on your list. Obtain your civil service retirement or your FERS annuity, the Thrift Savings Plan, and Social Security estimates. So how do you do that?
Well, you can do them yourself. There are calculators for all three, both the SERS, FERS. There's a calculator at OPM's website, opm.gov. There's a website called FedCalc, FedCalc.com. I've used that. It's pretty good. The TSP calculator is at TSP.gov, and the Social Security calculator is at SSA.gov. So you can do them yourself, which I kind of recommend, but your HR office has the capability to do it. And a lot of agencies have put software for general use on their intranet system, whatever it's called, calculators that you can use at your desk. A notable one is EBIS, which is DOD, at least Department of Army, and it may extend to the other DOD elements. But so there are plenty of calculators available. Reason I do them myself is not because the HR would make a mistake, but they can, and you can check them. And plus, you learn things by doing these estimates. And they're not hard. You sit at your computer and plug in the information, and it spits out a figure. And the only way it can be wrong is if you make an input error.
All right. Speaking of getting it right and whatnot. You said, have on the list here, attend a retirement seminar. And I know I've been to a number of retirement seminars. You have conducted a number of retirement seminars. And the one thing that I seem to notice from people is the questions that come out. It's a serendipity factor. And people ask things that would not necessarily be on the list, and you can really learn an awful lot about it by being, it's sort of the reverse of the wisdom of the crowd. The crowd has the questions, and the seminar of a presenter has the answers, hopefully.
Yeah, I rarely got stumped,
mm-hmm.
And almost never. But sometimes you get some doozies, but that are more judgment calls or, you know, what are your opinions of annuities, you know, mm-hmm. that. But that's the factual type stuff. Your instructor should be able to answer 99%, if not 100%, of those types of questions, factual questions. If it's a matter of opinion about something, you know, you can decide whether you want to accept advice
plus
or not.
Plus, the seminars in government are free. The government pays for them, but the attendee doesn't. And in many cases, they will let you bring a spouse or significant other, I think, correct?
Yeah, yeah, it's quite common. I know the ones I did, spouses would show up as well. Not all of them, but, you know, there'd be a minority of class members that would bring their spouses.
Okay, take a short break here on Federal News Radio. We'll be right back talking with John Elliott, the benefits expert. Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn, talking with John Elliott, benefits expert in the government, and as good as they get. And John gave me a list of do's and don'ts for people who are even considering retirement. And one of them is, and we've alluded to it twice, but it's the five-year rule. And it's one of those things, if you don't know what the five-year rule is, you could be in big trouble when you get ready to retire.
Yeah, it's simply you have to be enrolled in an FEHB plan. In one of them, not the same one for 5 years, but you have to be in the program for 5 years immediately preceding retirement. Now, if you're in the military and you're covered by TRICARE, either as the military member or your spouse, that will serve to meet the 5-year requirement. But if you're in that situation for, well, I've got TRICARE, I know it meets the 5-year requirement, but you want to leave your options open to carry FEHB into retirement, you at least have to be enrolled in one of the plans on the date you retire. Then what some people do, and I get a fair amount of questions from military about this, after you retire, you can suspend your FEHB if you don't need it, and then reinstate it during any of the annual fall open season after you're retired if you later find you do want or need FEHBP. So that's the 5-year requirement.
Right.
Now, you also meet, it's important to know, and I got a question about this the other day, where the questioner didn't realize that as a family member, it was a two-fed family, she was covered under her husband's family plan, and she didn't realize that she met the 5-year requirement
right.
by being covered as a family member. That my spouse, my wife, carried the FEHBP, so I was under her family plan, so I met the 5-year requirement. One reason she had it instead of me, and it didn't matter other than the fact that I was going to retire first, and the spouse that's still working should maintain the family plan to get the tax break.
Because
once you're retired, that tax break, that pre-tax benefit goes away. So that's another thing to consider. So whoever retires first, if you have the family plan, have it transferred to your working spouse's federal working spouse's plan.
You can suspend but never quit, right?
Well, you can always quit. That's not a good idea.
Don't do that.
You don't want to quit.
Yeah. Here's a question we'll maybe lump together. Do I provide a survivor benefit and how much? And also, how much life insurance will I still need when I retire? And I've had a couple of questions from people who say their life insurance agent urges them to buy life insurance rather than provide a survivor annuity. And I can see why a life insurance agent would think that's a good idea. But Survivor annuity is forever, correct?
A survivor annuity is forever. It's indexed to inflation, just like yours is. Under SERS, you can provide your spouse with your widow or widower up to 55% of what you were getting, or you can provide a partial. Under SERS, you can provide as little as a dollar a month. And why would people do that? That sounds kind of perverse. Well, situations where the spouse says, hey, I don't need a survivor benefit. I got my own money. I don't need it. Why should we reduce your annuity to pay for it between 9 and 10% or whatever amount if I don't need it? Well, okay. But you need some level of survivor annuity if the surviving spouse lives after the federal retiree with
health insurance.
Yeah. Right. So that can be key.
Yeah. And a buck would do it. A buck a month.
A buck a month. Yeah. The base level would be on your application $22.
Yeah.
That's as low as you can go. A lot of people under SERS will do $3,600 because you're only reduced 2.5% on the first $3,600 of your annuity. And so the spouse would get $1,900 a year or something like that, 55% of the $3,600, and that might be enough to pay for a self-only FEHBP out of her annuity, and that she wouldn't have to write checks to OPM every month, which they'll let you do if your annuity can't cover.
Yeah, but why bother? Yeah, you're right. Here's one that always brings a smile to people's faces, and then reality sets in, and you think maybe this is fairly serious question after all. I knew a retirement planner one time, and he said he used to tell the husband or wife, whoever the spouse of the person he was counseling, he said, pretty soon you're going to have half the income and twice the husband or wife that you now have. And you're talking about thinking about being with your spouse 24/7.
Well, it's going to happen at some point. You're going to be home together, presumably, for most people. And it's better to, kind of thrash out those issues in your mind and, of course, with your spouse. Retirement is one of the top 10 stressors we can experience, according to the psychologists. And I had no stress. Yeah. I was happy to retire. I was going to a second career doing retirement seminars. So I had no stress. But my spouse, also a retired federal employee, she didn't think she was undergoing any stress at all either. But she experienced shortness of breath.
Interesting.
To the point where once she insisted on going to the emergency room when we were out in San Francisco visiting our daughter, which was scared my daughter. But I knew, I kept telling her, no, it's stress. Because she'd been to the doctor before that and nothing wrong with her.
Uh-huh.
Nothing. They couldn't find any cause of this. So I said, well, it's psychosomatic. And we ran into one of the counselors that does part of our seminar at our annual party, and she said, yes, that was retirement stress. That shortness of breath is I've heard that before. I've seen it before. So my spouse, of course, your spouse never believes she believed her.
Get a third, second source.
Yeah, she believed
source.
Her. Yeah. So that's another thing you have to look at. And what are you going to do in your retirement? Are you both going to travel? Are you going to travel separately? do you have a big enough dwelling where you can each have your own room with a TV and where you're not jammed together? Things like that. You just have to kind of map out in your head, how you're going to deal with that. It's not going to be all of one glorious cycle of song, to quote Dorothy Parker, but, it should go well, presumably if things in your marriage are generally good.
Our thanks to John Elliott from the National Institutes of Transition Planning. Up next, OPM Director Catherine Archuleta. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and we're delighted to have the director of the Office of Personnel Management, Catherine Archuleta, with us. Director, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Hey, thank you so much for carving out so much time. I know, or I think I know how busy you are. I probably would be stunned to find out how busy you are, but we really appreciate you doing it. I have a totally off-the-wall question. It's an 80-degree day out there, and people will think I'm mad, but I knew John Berry when he worked on Capitol Hill, your predecessor.
Uh-huh.
He knew the government inside out. He loved it. He political scientist and all that. And when he was offered the job at OPM, he said the thing he dreaded most, and he wasn't kidding, was the snow days. Having to make that call, because it's so controversial, not only in Washington with people being Monday morning quarterbacks, but out of town for people who say we're wimps here in this city. And we had arguably the worst winter that certainly I can remember in the D.C. area, 2013-2014, maybe the worst in decades. It was even worse than our 33-inch snow year. And yet you seemed to come through it with flying colors. There were no major traffic jams, no deaths attributed to snow closing policy. We didn't have any of these mix-ups with calling people in and then sending them home. How'd you get it right?
Well, I have a great team that helps me all the time. We work with the National Weather Bureau, and then from there what we do is watch it the whole evening, and usually about 3 a.m. in the morning, we get together once again with a number of different teams, a protocol that we've established for how we call, and then we make the decision. But it's a lot of information that one has to digest. In 2013, there was one snow day, and in 2014, I know I was on 13 different calls. So I think we had actually four or five actual having to shut down the offices here in the Washington metro area.
Well, congratulations. One thing I like, a lot of people away from Washington don't realize, is that this is a huge geographic area. The metro region runs from West Virginia to the Chesapeake Bay. A lot of different weather patterns, a lot of different land in there, and some of the counties around here are very rural, and the schools have issues with it, too. So anyhow.
Well, what we were able to do is actually on one of the calls, what we do is we have all of the metro areas, agencies and departments really on the phone with us. So we're really talking to a number of different people. So we might have the transportation folks. We have different governments on the line. So we're looking at all of the indicators because the metro region is so big. It's not just taking a look what's happening at Washington, but as you mentioned, looking out around the entire region to see how easy it or difficult it will be for the employees to get into the district.
Well, to be such a horrible winter, that part of it went very well. So many of us thank you. Hey, the big ticket question for a lot of people is phased retirement. You know, it's been in the pipeline a while. Congress approved it. It's an extremely complicated issue. It's not just a matter of saying, okay, you can take phased retirement, work 3 days a week, we'll see you. I know there are a lot of questions and issues, and I was wondering where it is now in the pipeline.
Well, the proposed rule is still under review, and generally how, if this rule is approved, is that employees who are eligible retirement but want to stay in the same job could work half-time while getting half of their pension. And as they continue to work, these retirees would keep accruing additional service credit toward their final pensions. And while on the job, they would have to spend 20% of their time in mentoring activities, ideally with employees who will take over for them when they're completely retire. As I said, these regulations are under review right now, but I think they would create a system that promotes unique mentoring and expanded institutional knowledge. And we don't want to lose that knowledge as our leadership is retiring. So I think it offers a new and innovative alternative to traditional retirement.
Well, a lot of people are predicting that when this goes into effect, that there will be a lot of interest in it. A lot of people will be leaving, and that could solve some agency budgetary problems and problems related to sequestration.
Well, I think it offers an opportunity, another toolbox for the department heads and managers to really look at their workforce and do their workforce planning.
President Obama said he wanted to make government service cool again. And I know you and I talked about this previously, but to make it like it was, I assume he was referring to the Kennedy years, because I don't remember many times when it has been particularly cool. How do you do that, and is it happening?
You know, I think it isn't that government isn't cool, because I think it's pretty cool. I've been in government for most of my professional life, and I just think we need to do a better job of showing how that there are cool jobs, and that they exist right now. And I think my job is to make sure that a lot of folks know more about what is cool about government. For example, let me give you some examples of jobs we have in government, like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. You know, a lot of folks have been hit by the economy. There was a lot of individuals who had issues around housing and other financial issues. And the Financial Protection Board is a pretty neat place, because they're developing apps and guides to help families. In fact, they're even doing some apps and guides to help students and grads pay off their loans. And as I mentioned, for families to figure out how or what resources are available to help them facilitate their mortgage payments. You know, another one, this is close to home because I worked at the Department of Transportation. There are transportation safety specialist jobs at the National Transportation Safety Board that investigates accidents, whether it might be an aviation accident or a surface transportation accident, and to determine their causes. So it's sort of the forensic piece of that. And so I think that, you know, there really are cool jobs. I spoke to a young student in Texas just recently, and we talked about the fact that he was in medical school and what could he do. And I talked to him about, you know, have you thought maybe you could apply some of those skills to NASA? Because as we're thinking about where the next landing might be, they're going to need medical specialists to help them think through what the medical impacts are for any landing crews. So I said, wow, I could do that. And I said, yeah. He says, that's really cool. So I think there's lots of cool jobs.
Yeah, well, if you go to any of these awards banquets and see what people have done, it is mind-boggling.
It is. It is.
I know you're particularly proud of the government's role in the Affordable Care Act, and although federal employees aren't covered by it because they have their own system, OPM and the government have a role, don't they?
Yes, we do the multi-state plans, and we're very closely with DHS on the Affordable Care Act. I'm proud of the work that I was able to do in helping get information out to communities throughout the Southwest and other parts of the country during this sign-up period. And I got to see firsthand how important the Affordable Care Act can be to families who've lived without insurance. And so I'm excited about the work that OPM has done with multi-state. We were able to stand that up with no problems, and we continue to work very close with our partners at HHS.
And did I see somewhere, maybe it was in your blog, that you brought in almost 300,000 people, these are 300,000 or nearly, that didn't have insurance, and now they do?
I think that's, you know, we've really worked hard to do that, yes. We've brought in, we reached out through our multi-state programs. And so I think it's offered an alternative to many of the state programs as well that we've been able to add in.
Thanks to Catherine Archuleta, Director of the Office of Personnel Management, and benefits expert John Elliott from the National Institute of Transition Planning. Tune in next Wednesday at 10 a.m. for another edition of Your Turn with Mike Causey.